We come now to the final message of the book of Judges. And as you probably already guessed, that very last verse summarizes for us the whole book and once again the chapter that is before us. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Judges is a picture of life without Christ as our King. It illustrates how we all go astray, how each one of us has gone his own way, how we have done what is right in our own eyes, and the terrible situations that result when we rule our own lives and Christ does not rule us. And so this book acts as a commentary on those words from Isaiah 53. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Telling in various short stories of man's sinfulness and yet the relentless patience of God. God's goodness, God's grace, and we've seen Christ in every single chapter. Well, we come to the final chapter, and I'm sure you struggle to know how to read such a chapter because you're looking at Israel, you're looking at them seemingly warring against injustice and unrighteousness, and yet you come away with a very bad taste in your mouth. And that is deliberate. In this last section, we have a parody on religion. This is what religion without Christ looks like. You'll hear them talking about the name of God. You'll see the elders instructing the people of God to do the will of God. You'll see feasts and sacrifices to God. All the while, in the name of religion, they are breaking God's laws. This is a demonstration of religion without God. We will see religious obedience, people negotiating how to obey God, elders giving advice, sinful deeds done in the name of religious obedience. The event with the Levite and his concubine, you'll remember, have united Israel in military action. And they have taken action, united for the only time throughout the whole book of Judges, yet united to wage war against their own people. And in their zeal to purge the land of this evil, what have they done? They have committed genocide, almost, against one of their own tribes, leaving only 600 men of the tribe of Benjamin. What's happened to the children? Slaughtered. What's happened to the women? Slaughtered. The whole tribe of Benjamin has been wiped off the face of the earth, but for these 600 men. On top of this, chapter 21 reveals that in their zeal, the people of God had also made rash vows. Not just one, but two. And our chapter opens with the mention of a vow made in God's name to never allow their daughters to marry the people of Benjamin. This chapter then goes on to look at how they try to fix the situation. How they try to obey God in this chapter. And you'll see that it's a farce to call this obedience at all. These are men who are obviously ignorant of God, obviously ignorant of his word, obviously ignorant of his grace. Yet, they're trying to go out engaging in religious obedience. And in doing so, they make themselves only worthy of the justice of God. True holiness, we know, is in keeping all the commandments of God. But false religion results in pitting one law of God against another, in justifying breaking one law of God by keeping another. False religion, in its denials of grace, its pitting of God's laws against one another, its redefinition of sin, its attempts to find loopholes in order to disobey God while calling their disobedience obedience or offering strange fire to God. These are the characteristics of false religion that we see in this chapter. So I've got three headings for us as we look: rash vows, loophole obedience, and authorized sinning. Rash vows. And I guess the heading that I would write over this is, here's the nutshell of this first point. At the heart of all legalism is a basic misunderstanding of God and his grace. Because what you're going to see here is a bunch of people who are all about law, but have no concept of God's grace in this situation. So our story begins with the nation of Israel lamenting because they have taken a rash vow. Look at verses 1 and 2. Now the men of Israel had sworn at Mizpah, "No one of us shall give his daughter in marriage to Benjamin." And the people came to Bethel and sat there till evening before God, and they lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. They swore to never give their daughters in marriage to Benjamin. Now, no doubt these men, when they originally made this vow, were full of zeal, full of good intentions. But legalism is often guilty of offering strange fire to God and giving to him things that he never asked for. In this overcompensating gesture of godliness for a people prone not to be godly, they get themselves into trouble. Now, they put themselves into a very serious situation, haven't they? They have bound themselves by a vow in the name of God, and now they are caught between a rock and a hard place. What does the third commandment say? Shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Exodus 20 verse 7. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. And so this they are aware of. This they are feeling. This they feel is the pressure that is upon them and seemingly driving them towards keeping the oath that they had made. Now, let's put ourselves in their shoes for a moment and understand how things were working in the ancient world. God had insisted that all vows by the people of Israel must be taken in his name. Whether it was business dealings, whether it was the selling of land, whether it was promises like this, religious oaths and vows. God intended that the people of God should be those who, because of their fear of God, would walk as people of integrity and truth and keep their word, because they had taken a promise in God's name. That was the intention, that they would show themselves to be incredibly honest, you know, keeping their word no matter what, because I've taken a promise in God's name and I dare not, out of my worship and adoration of God, break that promise. That was the intention, to show the worthiness of God, to show a fear of God through keeping those promises. God intended to be glorified through their promise keeping. Now, keep that in mind. Is God glorified through the promise keeping of Israel in this chapter? Because I'm sure you can feel that there's something out of place in this chapter. God is a promise keeper. God always keeps his promises. God never lies. And that's what he intends of his people. But unlike God, we can bite off more than we can chew, and we can rush into promises that are wrong and would be sinful to keep, which is what we're seeing here in this chapter. Now, I mentioned the issue of legalism early on. Those who are legalistic tend to see God as a lawgiver, but not as a forgiver. A lawgiver, but not as a forgiver. They have an oversensitivity to law and penalties, but no instinct for grace. This is the instinct of every fallen sinner's heart. We are finely tuned to guilt because it is our biggest problem. We have this gift of a conscience, but which can be a curse, because when we try to please God, we end up overcompensating with our attempts. Instead of trusting in Christ, we try to use the law as a way to earn God's favor. And what often happens is, in this overcompensation, we forget his character and we end up doing terrible things with the law. Legalists see God as holy, which is correct. God is just, which is correct. A God who punishes sins, correct. But they do not see him as a God of grace, who forgives and who makes provision for our folly. They do not recognize that God is slow to anger and always ready to forgive. They make one aspect of God all of God, and by this they fall into error. Because in the Old Testament, what was the provision that God had made for those who had made a rash vow? Leviticus 5, verse 4 to 6. God makes provision for those who have committed themselves in vows sinfully, where he says, "Or if anyone utters with his lips a rash oath to do evil or to do good, any sort of rash oath that people swear, and it is hidden from him. When he comes to know it, and he realizes his guilt in any of these, and confesses the sin that he has committed, he shall bring to the Lord as compensation for the sin that he has committed a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat, for a sin offering, and the priest shall make atonement for him for his sin. Here is the nation of Israel. They know all about the third commandment. They know all about God's law, but they do not know about God's grace and forgiveness. Provision that he has made, that if they have made this foolish vow and they become aware of it, they can confess it and they will find forgiveness for that. They fixate on verses more like Ecclesiastes 5, verse 2 to 6. You will know these words, I'm sure. Be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore let your words be few. For a dream comes with much busyness, and a fool's voice with many words. When you vow a vow to God, do not delay in paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? Or maybe Psalm 15, verse 4. In whose eyes a vile person is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord, who swears to his own hurt and does not change. So some people are well educated on the strictness that God requires in these areas, but badly educated in the provision that God makes for our folly in these areas. They know all about the law, but they are ignorant of his grace. That's what we're seeing here in the ignorance of the people of Israel. They do not think that where sin abounds, God's grace abounds all the more. No, they think that God is impressed by costly obedience, that true obedience has to hurt somehow, that God is a sadist, not gracious, who wants us to feel the pinch for its own sake. They do not come to God in their brokenness to receive healing and forgiveness. But what do? Like every good legalist, they double down. They pick up the bludgeon of the law and they try to do heart surgery with it, and they break themselves upon it and they harm others as well as they hold themselves to their own legalistic religion. Legalism, because it does not cast itself upon God's grace, commits itself to the law and compounds the problem. And then notice the hypocrisy. Instead of seeing how much trouble they have made by committing genocide, and how they have added to that trouble with a foolish and rash vow, nearly resulting in Benjamin's extinction, they ask a question in verse 3. Just try and put yourself in their shoes. And they said, "Oh Lord, the God of Israel, why has this happened in Israel, that today there should be one tribe lacking in Israel?" Legalists are not able to see how they have been the cause of their own problems, how their own zeal has created the problem that they are now experiencing. They can only see their so-called obedience and good intentions. Israel has punished Benjamin. They have administered justice. They are seeking to honor God's name while keeping a rash vow. All of these actions and intentions make them feel good about themselves, blind to their faults. Zeal, sacrificial service, things done in God's name, they're all camouflage for religious sins. And here we see a remarkable question. God, how has this happened? How is it possible that one of Benjamin's tribes have nearly been wiped out? It's almost an accusatory question. Can't they see the sin of Israel? Can't they see the sin in Benjamin? Can't they see the sin in themselves? The folly added to folly that has brought this about. And so there's this question before God, but I'm sure they mean it sincerely. But that's just because they're so blind. I find this ironic because, you know, it's not only religious legalists who question God and justify themselves before God in this way. Atheism And legalism has the same problem. You know those atheists who say, why do bad things happen to good people? And legalists saying, God, how has this happened? They both can't see the sin in their own hearts. And they both make God almost the guilty person in this situation. Anyhow, that's the rash vow that we have seen. Let's look now at their loophole obedience to their rash vow. Blind to the error of their past ways, they continue headlong in their sins. And after a token worship service in verse 4, the people of Israel try and set themselves to problem solving. Look at verse 4. And the next day, the people rose early and built there an altar and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. Their questions before God, not being able to fathom why certain consequences have happened, and their legalistic insistence in not seeking forgiveness, but keeping on in their rash vows, their ignorance of God's grace on this count, put a question mark over this worship service, doesn't it? You're supposed to go, what are they thinking? As you read this, they do not turn to the Lord, but now they work within the confines of the legalistic pieces that they have established for themselves. In verse 5, they inquire into which of the tribes of Israel did not come to the summons to war against Benjamin. Because, lo and behold, what have they done? They made another rash vow. Look at verse 5. And the people of Israel said, which of all the tribes of Israel did not come up in the assembly to the Lord? For they had taken a great oath concerning him who did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah, saying, he shall surely be put to death. Not just one rash vow, but two rash vows. Well, we got to keep our promises. We made them in God's name. I mean, we can't try and find the forgiveness which the law provides for these things. Feeling justified in their overzealous zeal, they push on. You would think that they would see the problem. But they abound in their sinful words, and instead of casting themselves on God's grace, they push on. Like good legalists, they double down. And let us not miss, and I can't help but reading these verses tongue-in-cheek with a little bit of sarcasm. Just try and read verses 6 and 7 seriously. And the people of Israel had compassion for Benjamin, their brother. Now, let me ask you, have they shown compassion up until now? This is hard to swallow, isn't it? This makes it sound like Israel are being good guys, but this is deliberately showing you the unself-reflecting, unself-conscious compassion. And said, one tribe is cut off from Israel this day. What shall we do for wives for those who are left? Since we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them any of our daughters for wives. Why do they have the wife problem in the first place? Because they put them all to death. We see that no one came from Jabesh-Gilead. Look at verses 8 and 9. And they said, what one is there of the tribes of Israel that did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah? And behold, no one had come to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. For when the people were mustered, behold, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there. So here is their solution, where they're going to try and fix both their problems. They have to, in their minds, keep their rash vow to provide wives for Benjamin, so they decide to commit genocide against Jabesh-Gilead, steal their wives and give them to Benjamin. Can you feel this hole getting a little bit deeper? Look at verse 10 and 11. So the congregation sent 12,000 of their bravest men there and commanded them, go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, also the woman and the little ones. This is what you shall do, every male and every woman that is lain with a male you shall devote to destruction. Can you see the logic? If you want to fix a problem you have created by committing genocide, the solution is easy. Commit another genocide against someone else. Now, this would be an understandable action against an idolatrous tribe amongst the Canaanites. But this particular tribe are not guilty of that sin. And yet, they are being treated in this way. This is showing you an overzealous legalism that is driving these people, as they do not know who God is. They do not know what God requires. They do not know what the Lord of God says. And they're just spurting religious zeal in God's face. And it's going all over the people of God, and they're just causing destruction everywhere they go. Verse 12. And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with him. And they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. Read there, kidnapped them as prisoners of war. Do you think these young girls were glad to have their parents slaughtered, their prospective fiancés killed, as they were ripped away to be given to Benjamin, who now the whole of Israel knows what they've done? Is this a godly act on their part? Think of the emotions that these women are going through. We've had to live the experience of the concubine. That's one woman. Here are 400 more. They spared all the virgins because the widows would not have been good enough. But, of course, it only amounts to 400. These women were then gifted like slaves, like prisoners of war. But here's the upside. At least they've kept their vow. Wow. You know, here is the picture of a righteous man who keeps his word even to his own hurt. Even to the hurt of these 400 virgins. Isn't this a commendable way to be religious? Legalists find ways to fix their problems by apparent obedience and lip service to the law. The law of God is not merely concerned with a broken vow. Why does God give us his law? That we will know the good gifts of God. That in upholding the law of God, we will show forth the glory of God. God's laws are good. They are wise. They are for our benefit. When we keep God's law, God's love is put on display. When we do marriage God's way and two human beings flourish in this godly partnership, God's good gifts and his generosity to the human race are put on display. And in obeying the law of God, the goodness of God is put on display. Is that what we're seeing here? The goodness of God put on display as people keep his laws? No. We're not seeing any of God's love or his compassion or his kindness that the laws so often demonstrate. God seeks obedience to the law that brings about these characteristics in us. He is not seeking a use of the law that is exacting as far as the letter of the law is concerned, while showing a destructive rigor. Because if our obedience to the law glorifies God, or if our obedience to the law says something about God's character, what sort of God is this obedience to the law communicating? That God doesn't care about human life as long as you keep your promise? Is that the God? Because you know what this sounds like? This sounds like the God of the Canaanites. This sounds like one of those idols. Those people who sacrifice their children to gods for all sorts of wrong reasons. That's the picture that these Israelites are communicating about their God through their rendition of obedience to the law. This is not a gloriously informed, wholehearted obedience to the revelation of God. This is a God of their own minds that they're throwing an ignorant obedience to the law at. And it's incredibly destructive. So, these Jews who were seeking to not break a vow portrayed God to be a God who did not make provision for forgiveness for our follies. And so they go about destructively trying to serve this God. But let's look at the authorized sinning in the final section, verses 13 to 15. Then the whole congregation sent word to the people of Benjamin who were at the rock of Rimmon and proclaimed peace to them. So remember those 600 men who had taken refuge at the rock of Rimmon in the wilderness after they had been hunted down and hunted down and hunted down by the Israelites, and all the women and children and villages had been destroyed. Well, now this is a moment of reconciliation. Verse 14, and Benjamin returned at that time, and they gave them the woman whom they had saved alive of the woman of Jabesh Gilead, but they were not enough for them. And the people had compassion on Benjamin, because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Benjamin. Who had made a breach in the tribes of Benjamin? With woman in hand, Israel calls Benjamin from the rock of refuge and hand them over. Their refusal to seek forgiveness for their vows is now impossible, because they would then have to admit that they were also wrong in annihilating Jabesh Gilead. So they continue on this road, not content with only 400 stolen women. Well, they need to go and steal 200 more. Sinful resolution number one did not give them the full results that they needed. So now they need to resort to sinful resolution number two. The text highlights this problem by repeating again the matter of the rash vow. You see, the text itself is deliberately highlighting the problem of the vow. Read verses 16 to 18. Then the elders of the congregation said, "What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since the women are destroyed out of Benjamin?" And they said, "There must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe not be blotted out from Israel. Yet we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the people of Israel had sworn, 'Cursed be he who gives a wife to Benjamin.'" We know God's curse rests upon those who break God's law. But they have such a bankrupt view of sin that they can see no fault in their actions. They think they're being good. They offer a solution then to the men of Benjamin. Here is their solution, verses 19 to 21. Sanctioned kidnapping. Sanctioned bride stealing. So they said, "Behold, there is the yearly feast of the Lord at Shiloh, which is north of Bethel on the east of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebona." And they commanded the people of Benjamin, saying, "Go and lie in ambush in the vineyards and watch. If the daughters of Shiloh come out to dance in the dances, then come out of the vineyards and snatch each man his wife from the daughters of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin." Now, there are some questions that we could raise about which festival of the Lord is this. We know that there are three festivals for men to appear, but there is no festival for these dances for women. This is, the commentators suggest that this may be a carryover from some of the Canaanite religion that is just obliviously being practiced by Israel. So the question of the dances aside, the leaders who are supposed to uphold God's law and instruct the people on how to keep God's law, instruct the people on how to break God's law in the name of obeying a vow. They even offer to defend them when the fathers and brothers come looking for them. Look at verse 22. "And when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us, we will say to them," love this language, "grant them graciously to us." Now they're speaking about grace. "Because we did not take for each man of them his wife in battle, neither did you give them to them, else you would now be guilty." Whew. We saved you from sinning. You should be grateful. There's almost a little bit of that in there, isn't there? You should be commending us for our wisdom. I mean, look at our problem-solving skills. We're amazing. It's very interesting to note the limited way in which the leaders see guilt. Guilt is the breaking of an obvious law. But they do not see guilt as a motive of the heart. They do not see a broader understanding of sin as the Bible defines it. So as long as you're not technically breaking God's law, in other words, we're keeping one of our vows in God's name, even though you may be condoning another sin to do so, you're okay. legalists necessarily have to define law, redefine law, redefine sin, redefine obedience. Sin is not any want of conformity to all of God's law, but the condoning of sins in the name of service of what they consider to be more important laws. Look at verses 23 and 24. And the people of Benjamin did so, and took their wives according to their number from the dancers whom they carried off. Then they went and returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the towns and lived in them. And the people of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family, and they went out from there, every man to his inheritance. Our Hollywood-trained minds want to add these words, and they all lived happily ever after. Do you think you could write those words here? And they all lived happily ever after. It's completely inappropriate, isn't it? This is not a happy story. This is not a godly solution. This is not obedience to God's law. It looks like the problem of Benjamin has been solved, but what are the problems that have been created? These last few chapters began with the rape and murder of a single woman. And now here we are. All of this has led to the murder of all of the women of Benjamin, and now the stealing and no doubt raping of these 600 virgins. Forced marriages. This is not a happy story. The outward integrity of the tribes is intact, though. But what can we say about the spiritual integrity of the people of God in this chapter? It looks like Israel has a zeal for God's name, but they don't even know who God is. They don't even know what God's law says. They are serving a God that does not resemble the revelation that Moses has given to them. May God deliver us from this sort of religion. This chapter then ends reminding us that without Christ, this is what we become. Without Christ, this is what religion looks like. Look at verse 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That is the explanation for what you have just read. Unless God shines his light upon our best religion and exposes it for the man-serving wrangling that it is, to expose it for the God-insulting small God that we portray, we would be without hope. Isn't that exactly what Jesus Christ did in the first century when he came to shine a light on the Pharisees? Because they were just another version of the same thing, keeping the law of God by offering a divorce certificate while justifying their adultery, while breaking their promises but keeping certain vows that they had made by the altar but not by the thing on the altar. They were guilty of the same types of religion. Christ has come, and we have a king, and he leads us into true religion. So friends, let us conclude this book of Judges that we have been studying. This is a book that we have said has deconstructed the moralizing way in which we normally read the Old Testament. We read the Old Testament in an anti-gospel light, often, by making human beings the good, you know, the moral of the story, their good behavior, the thing that we should imitate, instead of seeing God as the hero of the Old Testament, and all of human beings a demonstration of the fall of Adam over and over and over and over and over and over, and over again, preparing our need for Christ. That's the story of the Old Testament, and Judges is part of that story. The book has the regular refrain that there was no king in Israel, whether that king be God or whether that king be a godly king like David, and how each man was going his own way and doing what was right in his own eyes. The book of Judges is dark and disturbing as it highlights the sin that we are all capable of, and our deep need for Christ. I personally loved preaching through the book of Judges because, for me, it's like preaching the gospel. There's bad news, you're a sinner, but there's good news. We have a God of grace. And so we have seen the deep sinfulness of the human heart and our deep need for Jesus Christ in every single chapter. But we must not miss that the part that this book plays in the developing story of the gospel in the Old Testament. The repeating pattern of the failure of the people of God to keep God's law, of the failure of all the leaders of God's people to deliver and lead them, all concentrate and drive towards what the New Testament will reveal in our need for Jesus Christ. This book plays a part in preparing the nation of Israel for the Anointed One, the King after God's own heart, the Davidic King. David is the man who will drive out the Canaanites, who will bring peace to the land. But even then, David himself becomes a type who, because he is a sinner, will fail and then adds to the chorus of "we're all sinners and we need Jesus," which is the basic chorus of the Old Testament. The book of Judges, like every other book in the Old Testament, speaks of God's plan to save sinners through Jesus Christ. Let's pray.